U.S.-Cuba relations may return to a pre-Obama-era situation. That means more restrictions on travel. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are fears that under the Trump administration, all diplomatic ties could be cut soon with Cuba. What does that mean for U.S. citizens wanting to travel to the island? Also, artists are looking beyond Wynwood at Miami Beach. The next space for art may be Alapata.
Will there be some gentrification? The answer is yes. It not only happens here, but it happens everywhere else.
We spoke with art collector Jorge Perez, the same one of the PAM, about a new art space that he's opened up in Alapata. Finally, Miami Art Week and Art Basel are upon us. Are you going? Art writer Brett Sokol will join us to give you a few tips on how to maneuver through this week's festivities. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. U.S.-Cuba relations seem to be on the fritz. Under the Trump administration, we may return to a point where the two countries aren't even talking to each other. In recent years, Trump dropped restrictions on educational and tourism visas. He banned some flights, and the embassies may close. What happens next, and how does that play out in 2020? What does it mean for people who want to travel to Cuba? We're joined now by America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you.
And to be with you.
So let's look at the recent thing. The most recent thing was that Trump banned flights to Cuba, all flights except the ones to Havana.
To Havana, right.
So what does that mean exactly?
Well, we're all still trying to figure out what exactly was the point of that, because if the point was to punish economically the Cuban regime, that's not really going to do it, because most U.S. tourists fly to Havana. They don't fly to the interior cities. Those flights were mainly for Cuban-American families who didn't want to have to fly to Havana and then take these god-awful long car and bus trips into the interior to visit their families. So if tourists who spend all that money that the conservatives fear is going into the pockets of the Cuban regime, if tourists aren't on those flights into the interior, we really don't know what the economic purpose of that move was.
And what about cruise ships? What's happened to cruise ships?
Cruise ships no longer go into Cuba. I mean, that's pretty much been cut off. American flights still can go in to Havana. That's about all that we're seeing now in terms of any kind of commercial travel traffic between the U.S. and Cuba. Charter flights can still go.
Okay.
Can still go in.
Has President Trump pretty much undone everything that Obama did?
Not quite yet. The big brass ring especially for conservative Cuban exiles here would be, who many of whom are voters who support Trump, would be to roll back the normalization of relations that President Obama began 5 years ago, this month actually, and completely sever ties, diplomatic relations with Cuba, which had been severed for more than half a century before Obama began them again 4 years ago.
So right now, if you want to travel to Cuba, what's the process? How do you get there?
Boy, your options are pretty slim these days. The most popular visa that Americans were using to go into Cuba since relations were normalized 5 years ago was what was called the people-to-people visa. That was struck down over this past summer by the Trump administration. Really, all that is left is what's called the support the Cuban people visa. But that takes a lot of paperwork, because you got to prove that you're really there, not, you know, for going to the beach or smoking cigars, but for interacting with academics or artists or, you know, specific Cuban people that, you know, you feel bring sort of a U.S. support to civilian society in Cuba. And you've got to make arrangements to stay in private Cuban homes, things of that nature, eat all the time in private Cuban restaurants, nothing state run. So that's there, but it's a little more difficult to get.
And what's the deal with the educational visas?
The educational visas are still there for academics. But again, you know, the criteria are getting tighter. And so, last month, Havana celebrated its 500th anniversary. It was a big deal. And under the Obama administration, you would have seen a lot of Americans go down there for that celebration, particularly from Key West, which a lot of politicians there, they're fairly liberal, and they are very much in favor of engagement with communist Cuba. You know, 3 years ago, they would have been able to take hundreds of people from Key West into Havana for that celebration, they say. But today, they say that it's just become so much of a hassle for Americans to travel to Cuba that hardly anybody went.
So coming back to what you said earlier about why Trump is doing this now and who is it really impacting, I mean, has he taken any example of, over the last 50 years of how the U.S. has tried to, you know, embargo Cuba to really hurt Cuba? Has he really done anything to hurt Cuba? Or is this just, I don't want to say ceremonial, just it's symbolic because, of course, the voters. He's just trying to think about the voters.
Well, all of the above. Really. I mean, he has hurt the Cuban regime in the sense that he's been able, for example, the cruise lines. Those were bringing a lot of money, you know, into Cuba on the part of tourists. And the fact that it's harder for Americans to travel, to visit Cuba now, that's taken some revenue away from things like state-run hotels and restaurants. But on the other hand, it has also hurt the Cubans we are supposed to be trying to support, meaning, for example, private entrepreneurs, the people who are allowed to start private businesses in Cuba, like restaurants and hotels. Those people are also being hurt very badly by the fact that it's harder for Americans to travel into Cuba now. And, you know, in terms of politics, as you just mentioned, I think, you know, that's the thing we really need to focus on. A lot of this is directed toward pleasing the, as I said before, the conservative Cuban exile vote here that does not believe in engagement with Cuba, that thinks we should keep isolating Cuba, and supports Trump as they did in 2016. He believes that those Cuban voters pushed him over the top in Florida, and they may well have for all we know, and he's really counting on them to support him at that kind of level again next year in the presidential election in 2020.
I'm talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. We're looking at the current relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Havana, as he mentioned, recently celebrating its 500th anniversary. Not a lot of news on that. And
no.
You would imagine that would be a really big story.
No, I mean, Havana is one of, I think it's the third oldest city founded in the Western Hemisphere, in the Americas. So its 500th anniversary is a big deal. And you're right. If it hadn't been for the fact that we have suddenly, you know, closed off, you know, U.S. travel and visitors, et cetera, to Cuba again, I think it would have been a big deal in the U.S. media. But you look at the major newspapers, they ran wire stories about it.
You recently talked with former Key West City Commissioner and a Cuban native, Tony Yanez. Here's what he said.
A lot of Americans feel as though either they can't go or it's just a hassle to go. And so they understood why there wasn't many more of us, as they call us, North Americans.
And by that, he's referring to people visiting from the U.S., right?
Right. When he says they understood, it means that the Cubans understood why there weren't more Americans at the 500th anniversary celebration for Havana. They know what's going on. They know that relations between Cuba and the U.S. have gone back to sort of, you know, animosity level. And so it wasn't a surprise to the Cubans that there weren't a lot of Americans there.
So how would you describe, I mean, that's what I was trying to wrap my brain around. Where are the relations now? And looking at the timeline of our histories, like, where are we compared to under the Bush administration, under the Reagan administration? I mean, going back, where are we right now with Cuba?
Well, things are still more positive than they were back in those days, because we still have full diplomatic relations with Cuba, which, as I said, were reestablished 4 years ago by the Obama administration. So there's still that. What the Trump administration is slowly going back to are, you know, the sort of the measures and the conditions to isolate Cuba that were very much alive back in those days. You know, travel, halting any kind of business to be done with Cuba, except for maybe agricultural aid, food aid, that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think that's where the Trump administration, particularly the very conservative Cuban leaders who are running Cuba policy inside the White House right now, people like Mauricio Claver Caron, I think their goal is to eventually, if not sever diplomatic relations with Cuba again, at least take us back to the kind of bilateral situation we had before the Obama administration.
How do you think this plays out going into next year? Again, South Florida was blue, but Trump probably, viewed those votes as what took him over the top,
right,
as you said.
Right.
You think about how, his relations with Cuba and how he's handled Venezuela. How do you think all this plays out next year in the election?
I think that if those Cuban voters believe that Trump really is, taking U.S.-Cuba relations back to pre-Obama conditions, I think they're going to be very galvanized to come out and vote for him as strongly as they did in 2016. And he's not only counting on Cuban voters to do that, he's hoping conservative Venezuelan voters will get galvanized to do that as well. He's hoping for more of a Hispanic, groundswell in Florida to put him over the top again. And Venezuela is very important in this whole discussion because one of the reasons that the Trump administration feels it's justified in hammering down on Cuba again is Cuba's support of that authoritarian socialist regime in Venezuela. That's one thing. The other thing is the situation with a dissident named José Daniel Ferrer, who was thrown in jail. He's a leading dissident thrown in jail in Cuba about 3 months ago and is reportedly being treated very badly. And our embassy in Havana, the chargé d'affaires there, Mara Tekic, has been vocally critical of the Cuban government for its treatment of José Daniel Ferrer. And the Cuban government then is calling her or is accusing her of attacking Cuba's sovereignty. The Trump administration then is accusing Cuba of harassing her. And so this is all boiling up and could be, that could be the situation that leads us to a severing of relations if that were to happen.
And just to mention again real quick, because I said it at the top, the embassies are still open, but really,
right.
How do
the embassies are open, but for example, even though we reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba in 2015, the Republican-led Senate, particularly Florida Senator Marco Rubio, refused to allow a U.S. ambassador to be installed in that embassy. Cuba does have an ambassador in its embassy in Washington, Jose Cabanas. But if our embassy is really has a shoestring staff right now, and there's not much going on with the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Washington. So even though we do have the embassies functioning, even though we do still have full diplomatic relations between the two countries, that's about it. Everything else is kind of moribund.
And you're going to have a piece tomorrow on the Latin American Report about the 500th anniversary, but also this relationship between
our
two countries.
Looking at just how precarious U.S.-Cuba relations are again, only 4 years after they were reestablished.
WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And you can hear his piece tomorrow on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Well, still to come, Wynwood may be the place for artists now, but the next hotspot for art may be Alapatta. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami entrepreneur and art collector Jorge M. Perez wanted to start Miami Art Week with a bang. His new art space, El Espacio 23, opens today. It's located in Alapatta and will feature hundreds of pieces from his own personal art collection that have been kept away in storage for many years. Last week, the Sundial team went to El Espacio 23 and talked with Perez about how he thinks the new space will advance South Florida's arts and culture ecosystem. And I started off by asking him why he wanted to open a new art space now.
With a growing art collection, I didn't have a place to put it. It was being stored in a lot of different smaller warehouse spaces, and I started looking for a central warehouse space to put my art in. But I wanted that space to also be a space where I could actually look at the art, not just store it, but take it out and look at it. As we found the space in Alapatta, and as we tore down all the walls of the existing warehouse, we started thinking that it would be good not just for me to be able to look at my personal collection, but to open it to the public, you know, for other people to enjoy the collection, which is what I always wanted to do with my art.
Why did you want to do it in the Allapattah neighborhood?
Wynwood, Miami Beach, and other central areas were too expensive. We were able to find this warehouse for a fourth or a fifth of the price that I would have paid for a similar warehouse in Wynwood. And it was very important, since we wanted this to store art, that it was affordable. And the second reason was, when you look at the map of Miami or Dade County, you will see that Allapattah is right in the middle. We're literally 15 minutes away from the airport, 15 minutes away from downtown, 5 minutes away from the second largest employment center, which is the hospital complex of the University of Miami and Jackson and Veterans. We are close to almost every place in Dade County. And we have expressways that are very, very close to the site. This was the perfect location.
Some will say this could be the next Wynwood, but you know, you think about the future, and if that's the case, how do you protect the community?
Fortunately or unfortunately, we live in a capitalist free economy. Prices in neighborhoods are determined by supply and demand. Allapattah has always been a community which was half industrial or warehousing, biggest produce markets, you know, wholesale export of, you know, fruits, vegetables, and so forth. Big wholesale of clothing along 20th Street and a lot of industries. The other half, which is to the north of 23rd Street, is working class residential. Will there be some gentrification as a result of not just this space, but the Rubels coming in nearby and other people announcing new housing developments? The answer is yes. It not only happens here, but it happens everywhere else. If you look at the Meatpacking District or Soho in New York, you will see that they were very rundown neighborhoods until somebody decided that they were good investments and the neighborhoods changed. I think that there will be change in Allapattah. Since we bought this warehouse, prices have more than doubled because we're looking for other space to store the art now that this has become an exhibition space. So those are the dangers of, you know, living in a free society. What are the things that can be done? You know, the city, for example, has 18 acres that they're going to put out for bid near the hospital. We can start looking with the public sector. What are the ways that we can build more affordable housing in neighborhoods so there's the least amount of displacement as possible? But in any type of neighborhood change, such as the one that I think will happen in Allapattah, there will be winners and losers. So the people that own their house, even though they're modest around here, all of those will win in the sense that the prices of their homes will go up. The ones that will lose are the ones that are renting, and probably their rents will also go up.
You talked about this as your collection because you wanted it to be on display to see and to share with people. How did you decide on the ones you wanted to put on display? Because obviously you still have to put some in storage. You don't have enough room for all of them.
Yeah, it's very difficult, right? I mean, you know, we have 1,600 art pieces right now in the collection. And this show, which fills up the whole space, it's a little over 100 pieces of 80 different artists. The first thing we do is narrow it down to a theme. You know, what do we want the exhibition to be? The first exhibition that I wanted this museum to have was one that's been very important to me from the very beginning of my collecting, which is art is not just about pretty pictures or something that rich people come to look at. Art is about the artist's perception of the world in which we live, particularly the problems of the world in which we live. So this first exhibit was about the artist as a social change agent. I wanted to talk, just like I have been talking about, you know, issues of immigration, issues of poverty, issues of homelessness, issues of the discrepancies, the growing discrepancies, inequalities between the rich and the poor, issues about racism. One of my favorite pieces is a video by William Kentridge from South Africa that is a three-channel video and talks about the history of contemporary Africa. He's one of the greatest artists of the 20th, 21st century. And he, in that video, he talks about the war, apartheid, and the effect that recent history has had in South Africa, particularly on its majority of the population, which of course is black and is poor.
I'm speaking with Miami developer, art collector, and philanthropist Jorge Perez. Perez opened El Espacio 23, Space 23, in Alapata. It's a new art space which features thousands of pieces from Perez's personal collection that were kept away in storage. You can find more information at WLRN.org.
How does, you know, what you're doing right now, for example, tie into the turmoil that we see in places like Venezuela, as an example?
Well, this exhibit talks about that, you know, the issues that those that our countries in Latin America are having. And it's not just Venezuela. It's Venezuela, Cuba, Mexico, Chile, the, you know, Argentina just had a huge change in government. Bolivia just had a huge change in government. So we have all this turmoil. And if you go around, you will see that there are many pieces that directly relate to the Venezuelan issue, you know, to the immigration issue, which is a huge issue here, to the issue of drugs and death because of drugs, you know, both in the United States, to the issue of police brutality against, you know, minorities, profiling and so forth. These pieces are directly dealing, not in a hidden way, but very, very much in a very direct, upfront way.
You've made your success in real estate, but I wonder, how did that grow in tandem with your passion for the arts and investing in the arts in South Florida?
Because I started loving the arts way before I loved real estate. So I was the type of student that if you would have asked somebody that I was going to be an entrepreneur when I was both in high school and in college, they probably would have laughed at you like crazy. I just was not interested in business at all. I was much interested in philosophy and economics and social change. So I went to Europe and I started collecting art while I was in college, whatever I could afford, which wasn't very much, limited edition lithographs of artists that I liked, like Miro and Man Ray and this other artist, which I still have. But when I went to Europe, I was deciding whether I was going to go back to South America or not. I came to the United States to go to university and then really fell in love with the way Europeans lived in cities. I love the fact that they didn't shop in these big refrigerators and store the food for a month. But, you know, they were coming down with their baguettes underneath their hands, and they would have coffee every morning in this neighborhood bars, you know, and they would see each other after work, and they would shop fresh, but in much smaller quantities. The kitchens look minute to me compared to American kitchens. And it was a different way of life, and once that I thought, this is what civilization is about. You know, the people talking to each other in close-knit neighborhoods is what has produced our civilization. It wasn't going after work to your one-acre house, one hour away from where you work, and then not seeing anybody. That's when I decided to become an urban planner, changed my career to become an urban planner, still not thinking that I was going to be a businessman, and then started working with the city and doing affordable housing. And that's how I did my first private sector affordable housing job. And from there, I started doing other things. And almost by mistake, I became a developer and a business guy.
For you, why get into affordable housing when the investment could be so much greater in the demand for luxury?
I always loved to be involved with neighborhoods and changing neighborhoods from day one. Actually, before I started working, when I was doing my master's degree, while a lot of people were doing more design in the urban planning and design school, I was always doing projects that had to do, it happened to be the University of Michigan, so it was changing Detroit neighborhoods, which were falling rapidly. So I always had this passion for neighborhood change, you know, to make low-income neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, affected neighborhoods, better places for people to live in. So it was an easy transition to go into affordable housing. You know, all of a sudden I said, oh my goodness, I'm doing the same thing that I did while I was in the public sector, and now I'm making money out of it, right? And it was a wonderful joy. I remember the first two jobs that I did, one was in Little Havana and one was in Colmar in downtown Miami, both elderly jobs. And it was incredible going to those two little jobs, which I still own, by the way, and the elderly coming up and giving you your cafecito. And you felt incredibly important and that you were doing something so worthwhile in the community. And that always stayed with me. And through thick and thin, we would continue to do affordable housing. And now our affordable housing division is extremely active. We're doing these transformational projects, where they announced one on the river. We're doing Liberty Square. We're doing one in Tampa that is, again, the same size, you know, mixing incomes, you know, bringing retail in, because we don't want to make the mistakes of the past, right? We don't want to just concentrate all poverty in one place, make it all public housing, you know, and it looks really good for a while, but afterwards it doesn't work.
You know, we talk about affordable housing, and you know, you've got a plan for Espacio 23, which is, you know, to provide units for artists, and we're actually inside of one right now. Tell me a little bit about that idea, and how do you envision this working?
The individual artist is very important to us, and young artists in particularly, just like young actors or young ones, anybody in the artistic world, are not economically doing very well. So we wanted to promote artists from Miami and from around the world by creating these three spaces here, in which contemporary artists can come and work and live. So here you're in the apartment, and they're going to have a beautiful apartment with a kitchen and all that stuff. And outside, they have studio space. So not only are they going to be able to live here, but work here. And that's very, very important to us. And we're going to do it for both artists and for curators. Right? Because I think the curation of art is very, very important, and we need to develop that. Not only are we having these three spaces, but we're working with, you know, residency programs in Colombia, in Cuba, here in Miami, residencies and the promotion of artists, young arts, and the promotion of artists is what we want to do for Miami.
What do you envision for this space? What do you envision for the future of, you know, your collection here for the public?
I hope that it becomes another important part of Miami as a world-class art center. I hope that it becomes a space that when people want to see art, they have different venues and different types. You know, there are several private art spaces here already. There are several museums that are very good other than the Perez Art Museum, ICA, the one in Fort Lauderdale, the Bonnie Clearwater Rides, MoCA, you know, the Bass in Miami Beach. So we're really getting sort of this ecosystem of art spaces that I think it's unique to Miami, and I think it's very, very good for the growth of Miami as a great city.
Well, you've been listening to a conversation that we had with Miami developer and art collector Jorge M. Perez about his new art space called El Espacio 23. It's located in Alapata, and it's featuring hundreds of his pieces from his own personal collection. You can find more information at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Miami Art Week kicks off in South Florida with the satellite fairs and exhibitions. What are you going to be checking out? We've got Brett Sokol, who'll help you maneuver through all that. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Art lovers from around the world are descending upon Miami for the start of Miami Art Week in Art Basel. Are you feeling a little bit overwhelmed with everything that's going on? Because there is a lot. This event brings all kinds of galleries and presentations and events and satellite fairs. I mean, the list goes on and on. Joining me now is Brett Sokol. He is the contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times and the co-founder of Letter 16 Press. It's a nonprofit publishing house that's focused on Miami photographers. He's going to help us navigate through this as he does every year. Brett, always great to have you.
It's great to be back.
Let's start before I talk about Art Basel and Art Week, though. You were listening with me about this conversation that I had with Mr. Perez about his new space, El Espacio 23 in Alapata. We did get to go. Chris Remington and I went. We got to see it. It is a huge space, a lot of work. It's his own personal collection that he's sharing with people. This is not new, though. We've talked about this before. Wealthy collectors who open up their art for everybody. And that's a good thing, right?
I would say on the whole, yes, it's a good thing. It's part of the phrase that he used, the ecosystem of art here in Miami. There are people who have some ambivalent feelings about this, people who wonder, well, gee, I wish that this collection of art and the money behind it was being put into public museums like, say, oh, I don't know, the museum that actually has George Perez's name on the side of it, PAM. But, you know, he's made it clear that he is not going to lessen his financial commitment to the museum. I'm sure that set a lot of pulses at ease over at the museum itself. And another way to look at this is with these private museums, if these collectors weren't opening these private museums, which are open to the public, people can come see it. The only way that a lot of us would be able to actually see a lot of this really stellar contemporary art is if we scored a private dinner invitation to these folks' home. So at least this way, whatever your issues are with the private museum, you and I can actually see the art that these people have.
I don't think I'm ever going to get onto those invitation lists. But the other thing, too, that I found interesting is that it's in Alapata. So, I mean, so much focus is on Wynwood, but really, and we've talked about this on the program, is now artists are scattering out for other places. Little Haiti's a big one. Now Alapata, because he's not the only one who's got real estate in there where he's putting up his art.
Yes. One of the most impressive collections of contemporary art is relocating from Wynwood to Alapata. That's the Rubel family. And they are opening this Wednesday, the Rubel Museum in Alapata. It's a 100,000 square foot complex with a collection of contemporary art that is the envy of any museum in this country or anywhere else around the world. It's very impressive. A lot of really wonderful work will be on displayed to the public there.
Is that how it starts? You have a couple of wealthy collectors. They find a cheap area, pop up the art, and now all of a sudden everybody wants it. But and part of it also the fact that it's cheaper than Wynwood.
It was cheaper. The prices are certainly already skyrocketing in Alapata. There's a lot of serious real estate players who've moved in there. And if you want to read the handwriting on the wall, it's a lot of the same players who moved into Wynwood before Alapata. And some of them are the same people who moved into South Beach before Wynwood. And we know what happened in each of those places previously. I would say this, though. I hear a lot of people constantly talking about the art scene in Wynwood. I would say Wynwood is a really good test case of how not to build a thriving art community. There was a lot of really interesting things going on there in the early aughts, again, because it was cheaper and more affordable. If you wanted to open up a gallery, you could get a warehouse space there. Artists could get studios there. It was affordable. And you created something of a community of artists. That is over. And I know the Chamber of Commerce probably doesn't like me to say that, but if someone says, hey, where can I go and see really interesting Miami gallery showing top-notch Miami art, it is not Wynwood. Please spare yourself the traffic nightmare.
You said Little Haiti.
Yes. Most of the better galleries, meaning galleries that were showing really interesting art, particularly art by Miami artists who were in Wynwood, most of them have moved up to Little Haiti. And here's the important thing. A lot of those galleries learned the hard way that there is only one way to not become a victim of gentrification. You have to own your own building. If you're a gallerist, you've got to own the building. Otherwise, once you've put all this time into drawing people to an otherwise semi-deserted neighborhood, you will be priced out. And so a lot of these galleries have bought their spaces in Little Haiti.
Do you think Alapata will go in that direction, the Wynwood direction? that everybody's going to start moving there?
Well, there aren't a lot of galleries that have opened up shop in Allapattie yet. There's one notable one, Spinello Projects. They're there. And they've got a really interesting group show that's opening up this week with a fantastic Miami artist, Clara Varas, who does these, you could call them mixed media paintings and sculptures, but that clinical term doesn't do justice to how wonderful they really are. She starts by painting on a bedsheet almost, often, yes, bedsheets, and then adds all kinds of found items that she picks up from around Miami. And the end result is far more than the sum of its parts. They're really gorgeous and fascinating to lose yourself in. And so if someone says to you, what's an interesting Miami artist, a new talent? That's one person right there. Clara Varas, her works at the Spinello Projects. But aside from Spinello, who's been around and been showing great work in Miami for many years, most of the folks moving into Allapattie so far are the bigger players. Again, like collectors buying up large warehouse spaces. Right. I haven't seen a lot of other notable galleries move in there yet.
And I want to mention, by the way, too, is as you were talking about a local artist, that your last piece, you know, in the Times, you talk about some of the local artists, and you have links there so people could check it out if you want to see who is doing what here in South Florida. Miami Art Week and Art Basel. Real quickly, though, Art, for you, Brett Sokol, what is your itinerary? What are you doing during this week? I want to know. I figure if I follow you, I'll get everything.
The circus is in town. Yes, there's almost too much going on. And not only are you not able to see it all, you shouldn't bother trying to see it all. There's a lot of schlock, a lot of mishigas. If you want to focus on the really, truly transcendent artwork sort of highlights, first of all, at the very least, if you do nothing else this week, go to the main fair, the Art Basel Fair at the Convention Center on Miami Beach. It kills me how many people go to one of the smaller satellite fairs or some pop-up event or something where, I mean, Paris Hilton, for God's sake, is back in town again doing God knows what art thing. And this, to a lot of people, is Art Basel. It's not Art Basel. These are these ancillary events. Art Basel is an actual fair with 269 galleries all set up inside the convention center. All the work's for sale, but anybody can go and essentially window shop. You just buy a ticket on site. It's, as I wrote in the Times, it's very pricey window shopping. Tickets are $65 a head. So think of it as a museum exhibition you're going to visit. You can get a really good snapshot of the contemporary art world by spending an afternoon going through the main fair. You'll see a lot of the moment work. You'll see a lot of really wonderful pieces from the past few decades, and even some earlier post-war stuff as well.
It's interesting. You know, work for art. And sometimes I think people think, oh, but it's like stuff that only rich people could buy. It's six-figure, seven-figure art pieces, and those exist. But there is art anybody can buy. There is opportunity for everybody.
Yes, and I would say in that case, that's something where you want to spend some time in the actual Miami galleries. And we do have some really wonderful galleries. There are three of them in the main fair. Yes, a total of three of the 269 galleries are Miami-based. That's a sore spot for a lot of people. But those three galleries are showing some fantastic Miami artists, and they have gallery spaces outside of the fair that are here all year round. Frederick Snitzer, who's got a gallery in downtown Miami, he's showing work by the Miami artist Hernan Bas inside the convention center at the main fair. Absolutely gorgeous paintings that Hernan Bas has done. And he has new work by Tomas Asson, which is at his gallery space in downtown Miami, who is a Cuban exile artist who relocated to Miami in the 90s. We haven't heard quite a lot from over the past few years. He's been a little quiet or sort of hunkered down in his studio painting, but he has some new, literally humongous canvases that he's going to be debuting. So that'll be interesting to see. Let me also mention another great artist, Meta Tomarup, who is showing new work, new abstract paintings that are going to be up at the Emerson Dorsch Gallery in Little Haiti. And you should definitely go to Emerson Dorsch's website or call them, because not only are the paintings themselves fabulous to look at, but they're doing performances with them where Meta and some of her assistants pull the canvases off the walls and create let's just say the paintings come to life, and it's the kind of show where you immediately will be as excited as you were when you were 8 years old seeing something larger than life. I don't want to ruin it, but it's pretty special.
Well, it's a little bit of a lot for everything. I'm talking with Brett Sokol, contributing writer on arts and culture for the New York Times, also co-founder of Letter 16 Press, a nonprofit publishing house focused on Miami photographers. We're talking about Art Basel. I say Basel. We have this argument all the time. I know. I think it just comes out that way.
It's on me. I got reprimanded once by someone from Switzerland who said, Basel is what you put on your food. Basel is where you go.
But you know what we're talking about, that and Miami Art Week. You know what? It's you think about art. We were talking about this before, because before the segment, I was asking you about, if you're an artist, where do you need to go to make it? You still got to be in the big cities. You still got to be in New York. You still got to be in Paris. You still got to be in some, you know, Miami. Miami is on that list now. Miami is a place for an artist if you want to make it, right?
Which is something new. It's, you know, for the longest time, if you were talking about art cities, places where artists can make a living as an artist, it was really just LA and New York. And it's not to say that there haven't always been really talented artists in Miami. There have, going back to the 60s and 70s. The difference was that as an artist in Miami, there was no market for you here. There weren't any local collectors, or even more than, literally you can count them on one hand, who were buying work by emerging Miami artists, which basically meant that you really had two choices as a Miami artist. You could either get a teaching job to support yourself and essentially paint on the side, or you could get a U-Haul and move to New York. And what really started to change in the aftermath of Art Basel's arrival, its first edition of Art Basel was 2002, was that this spotlight got shone on the Miami art scene. And you had suddenly a lot more people in Miami becoming collectors, starting to collect Miami artists. And you had a lot more people around the country and also in Europe focusing on Miami artists.
See, I was about to ask you, the egg or the chicken? So Basel, I'm going to say it that way, Basel comes, then all of a sudden you start to see Miami become the center for art and artists, right?
Yes. I think things were percolating a little bit in the years before the fair came. It's one of the reasons why the fair chose Miami as opposed to another American city to open up their American edition. They have the flagship fair when they first, still goes on, is every June in Switzerland. And they had decided that at that point they wanted to open one in America. And the question was where. They could have gone anywhere. And Miami essentially, you know, rolled out the red carpet and said, this is the place to come. And that's what they opted for. And it's really paid off handsomely for the Miami art scene. Things have dimmed a little bit, but I mean, there was just a huge explosion of activity and interest in Miami artists that grew and grew and grew year after year. And I don't think that really would have happened without the fair coming here. So whatever criticisms you might have of the fair, you have to credit it with really becoming a catalyst to take the Miami art scene to another level.
And, you know, you touched on some of the local artists, but when you have something like a Basel that comes through, you also have artists from all over the world, because this is the opportunity to be seen, to sell. You know, but that's one of the complaints people will say. It was like, if I want to see New York artists, I can go to New York. But really, do you find that the mix is good? That there are, and there is enough highlights for local artists?
No. I think one of the problems that's happened is that the circus is so big now that a lot of homegrown talent gets sort of shoved off stage. The fair and so many of the events that take place that are put on by big New York players suck up all of the oxygen out of the scene. So I mentioned how things have dimmed slightly, and part of that is because there's so much going on. In the first few years of the fair, there were not two dozen satellite fairs, and there weren't 30 million parties, and Paris Hilton wasn't competing for people's attention with some kind of event. Now literally you have product launches of everything under the sun with only the most tangential art component that is called Art Basel. And so the first few years of the fair, you had the main fair, you had one, maybe two satellite fairs, a couple of VIP dinners. What that meant was that you had all of these collectors coming into Miami, and they suddenly had all this extra time. They did the fair, maybe they did one satellite fair, they had a dinner or something, and then they went and focused on Miami. Miami galleries, Miami artists, really soaking up some actual Miami flavor. And that's doesn't happen these days as much as it used to, simply because there's so much else going on that all the big New York galleries come down and they have their own events for all of those out-of-town collectors. And there just isn't as much time for those folks to actually explore Miami itself, as opposed to all of these sort of pop-up events that people from out of town throw this week and then disappear when the week's over.
Bigger picture, taking a look at just, I want to look at art itself right now. What is, you know, what is happening in art? What is the thing? Because you think about where we are in the world, what's happening in the world, and in this country, we're coming up on an election. How does the art reflect? What are we going to see? I really, what I'm getting at is, what are we going to see?
I don't think contemporary art that stands the test of time is necessarily strongest when it reacts to whatever happened yesterday. And is there a lot of political art that's responding to what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now? Yes. Is it good? No. I don't say that happily. It's just, you know, that's the fact. I think it takes a lot of time for these things to germinate within artists and for them to come up with statements that aren't just agitprop or that aren't just some kind of political propaganda from whatever position, but something that speaks deeper to the human condition. I think that I'm as anxious to see those works as you are. It's why I'll be going out this week to a lot of different places to see all kinds of wonderful stuff.
I've always been fascinated, too, by this is whatever's happening in the economy, how does that impact, or how is the art buying impacting the economy? Right now, what's happening on that side of the economic side? Are a lot of people buying art? Is this a time to buy art?
Look,
I mean, if you've got a lot of money, I guess.
Art is a luxury good.
Yes,
so if you want
exactly.
I mean, the easy answer is, you know, how is the art market doing? The answer to that is, how do rich people feel? Are they comfortable spending a lot of money right now? If they are, then the art market's thriving. If they're not, if they're holding back, if they're a little worried, then the art market tends to contract a bit. I mean, that's the fact of the matter is that, if, particularly if we're talking about at the Art Basel Fair, you've got, you know, there's nothing, the bargain in there is something that, you know, is maybe 10,000, maybe, you know, and then they go up, you start adding on lots of zeros. So nobody needs contemporary art to get, you know, I mean, it's something, it's a luxury good. And so it's like any other luxury good. It's affected by, you know, by how wealthy people feel about the economy.
I just like to look at expensive art and pretend I'm wealthy. That's all. That's, you know what, again, coming back, you said that if you have one recommendation, it's go to the main fair. Let's say you have a newbie, somebody who's never been, they have a day, maybe two. So the main fair, anything else you'd recommend? How else to consume this week?
Day two, go to the galleries. See some Miami artists. Once you've knocked off the main fair and you've sort of seen this broad overview, then figure out what you like. I mean, it's like when you ask me, you know, is there art that, you know, that is blank? Well, the beauty of it is that everybody has different tastes and you can follow up on what you're interested in. You might see something at the fair that piques your interest, a particular artist. You can then look for that artist in other places. Here's something else I would say, actually, that is time sensitive. The larger art museums in town tend to get a lot of the attention from the press. There's two smaller museums who are both located on South Beach that both have great shows right now that are definitely worth seeing. One of them is the Jewish Museum of Florida, who have a knockout show of photographs by Zachary Balber that are, I guess the shorthand is, he sort of mixes Yiddishkeit with thug life. And if that sounds jarring, that's the way it's supposed to be. And also the Wolfsonian FIU, also on South Beach, which is a museum that was founded by Mickey Wilson Jr. As sort of a repository for his collection of, you know, they call it art of the idea, or he's very interested in historical propaganda. I would say really fascinating historical curios that he has spent decades searching the world for, hunting down, and are now on display to the public in this museum. They have essentially an 80th birthday tribute to him with a lot of the most wonderful things that he's found over the years. And that's there. And it's seeing his collection, I like to think of him as Miami's answer to Willy Wonka. in the best way. He is a really unique individual who gives the term collector a really wonderful connotation.
See, every time I bring Brett in, I get one of those references. This one was Willy Wonka. Last time it was Game of Thrones. That's all I need. Brett Sokol, again, a contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times and the co-founder of Letter 16 Press, nonprofit publishing house focused on Miami photographers. Brett, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy this week. I know that you will.
Don't drive.
Do not drive. That's our program for this Monday, December 2nd. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, how much funding has been given to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands for recovery after Hurricanes Irma and Maria? We're going to talk to a reporter from the New York Times about their recent examination of FEMA data. They found that FEMA was giving the Caribbean islands less money than they were to recovery on the mainland. And a new film shot entirely in South Florida tells the story of a black family who are facing loss, drug addiction, and forgiveness. We're going to talk with the director and writer of Waves. You can see a trailer, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Also, two Knights Arts Challenge winners will join us to tell us about their fascinating projects. All of that tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin with Morning Edition. That extra car of yours, the one you'd like to get rid of, it's worth something. So why not donate it to support this station? Here's how.
Just call 877-WLRN-CAR or visit WLRN.org.
Whether you were born here or moved here later in life, you've chosen to make Broward your home. You care about this community, and when issues arise, you don't wait for others to act. You look in the mirror and ask how you can make a difference. An endowed charitable fund of the Community Foundation of Broward could be the most effective way to create bold impact on the issues you care about most. You can put your fingerprints on Broward's future and be bold with the Community Foundation of Broward. Learn more at cfbroward.org.
Next year's U.S. Census will be the first conducted mostly online. To make sure that doesn't lead to an undercount of communities of color, one organization in Georgia is setting up free Wi-Fi hotspots.
We have an opportunity to be counted and to show up. And if we don't, then we're losing money. We're also losing power in terms of influence and representation.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story Monday afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 here on 91.3 WLRN and HD1 Miami, Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1 Marathon, Key West, 90.7 WFLV HD4 West Palm Beach, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. It's 2 o'clock.